At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Can you be contrite and defiant at the same time? You can if you're the leader of one of the world's biggest media empires. Rupert Murdoch faces angry shareholders at News Corp's annual meeting.
The company has been the subject of both understandable scrutiny and unfair attack.
He even called his approach, no kidding, fair and balanced. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Thanks for making us a part of your Friday, this 21st day of October. One commentator called today's event Rupert Murdoch's Rosebud Moment, referring to that famous lament of the publishing magnate in Citizen Kane. But if the 80-year-old head of News Corporation was feeling regretful today, his brusque and combative demeanor didn't reflect that. He vowed to put things right with the media empire's British phone hacking scandal. But as he faced his annual meeting of shareholders here in Los Angeles, he was anything but deferential to the dozens of protesters who gathered at the Fox Studios lot. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports on the scene inside and outside.
More than 100 people rallied outside Fox Studios. One protester wore an oversized Halloween mask that resembled Rupert Murdoch. Several others carried signs that said, "Fire the Murdoch Mafia."
Shame on you!
Okay. Shame on you!
Los Angeles resident Lauren Steiner came over from Occupy LA.
I would like to see Rupert Murdoch, his sons, and all the non-independent board members fired.
Things didn't get any friendlier inside the meeting. One angry shareholder after the next bashed the company for poor corporate governance in the wake of the phone hacking scandal at the News of the World, the now-defunct British tabloid. Murdoch vowed to fix things.
That's the position. We will put this right.
Still, there were challenges to Murdoch's power in the company. Some suggested the corporate culture couldn't change until the leadership did.
Well, yeah, I would say you are at least the chief cheerleader in terms of the culture, and in some ways the person who...
Yeah, but you're suggesting I'm a very bad person.
No, I'm not.
Murdoch and shareholders loyal to him control nearly 50% of the vote. That gives the family and much of the board a lot of job security. David Joyce is an analyst with Miller Tabak.
Well, clearly this is what normally happens in a situation where you've got dual voting classes of stock. The Murdoch family owns 12% of the equity, but they own 40% of the vote.
Joyce says the fight over News Corp is far from over. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Europe's finance ministers say Greece will get more aid money sometime around mid-November, another 8 billion euros or 11 billion in U.S. dollars to ward off default. There's also another aid package in the works for the debt-laden country. There's been both good and bad news out of Europe all week, and that had the markets a little jumpy. So on to the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond. We've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Hi there.
Hi, Bob.
And John Carney from CNBC. Welcome.
Thank you.
Lee, this latest bailout news from Europe comes after a parliamentary vote for even more austerity measures in Greece. So are we finally on the path to an improved situation in the eurozone?
That's the big question. I mean, Greece has definitely taken a turn for the worse. There's a school of thought out there that no amount of money is going to be enough to avoid a default. The most important thing is just preventing contagion. Europe is on the verge of its second recession, really. And the degree to which the situation in Greece can be contained, really, a lot is weighing on that. And whether that means a reasonable orderly default or just throwing a lot more money at it, that still remains to be seen.
What do you think, John? Breathing easier?
Well, that's the big bet that the European leaders are making, that they can somehow contain this to Greece, that if they either prevent a Greece default or make or somehow have an orderly default on Greek bonds, that that will prevent contagion from spreading. But there's no evidence that that's true. In fact, what a lot of people who I've talked to say is that once you solve the Greece problem, people will then move on and say, okay, now let's look at Italy, and now let's look at Spain. In other words, the dominoes might keep falling, and so it might not be containable at all.
John, the markets have been up and down all week. Was it all Europe, or was something else at play?
It's a lot of Europe. It seems like every day we get multiple rumors and then multiple denials of rumors about what's going to happen in Europe. There was also some signs of economic life in the U.S., that some things that might not have been as bad as it seems. So I think that also gave us a bit of a boost this week.
Yeah, wasn't it just yesterday, though, that we were all worried about the future? Lee, how can it be the Dow moved back into positive territory for the year today?
Oh, it's just that we're so sensitive to these moves. Although I will say we finally gotten to the point where the Dow can go up 200 points and then down 200 points, and it no longer makes the big headlines because we're kind of used to it. But I think it's really premature to look at any positive signs because, as we've learned over the past 36 months, that you know, you can't write the positive story with a pretty little bow too soon. And the uncertainty in Europe is driving a lot of volatility and will continue to do so. And then we also have our unemployment crisis. The scars from that are not going to be very easily healed. Maybe not forever. I don't want to be too ominous. But.
Oh, thanks. On the domestic front, the president's plan to get his jobs bill passed piece by piece hit a wall this week. His first measure to protect teachers from layoffs failed in the Senate. I mean, is there any hope that he's going to get anywhere on this front, or is he up against the politics? What do you think, John?
I think he's up against the politics, that there's not going to be any progress on this front. Everybody is basically already campaigning for 2012. Nobody wants to give the president a victory on anything. And particularly when some of the pieces of this are things like helping government workers, when you have tell a Republican you have a jobs bill, they think that means creating private sector jobs. When Barack Obama presents his job bill, he thinks that's not even necessarily creating public sector jobs, but preserving them and preserving the rate of pay. And I think that's a fundamental divide between the Republicans and the Democrats, and I don't see them coming together anytime soon.
So quickly, Lee, any action in the next year at all?
On the jobs bill, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, this next piece is the piece that it was, if there was one piece that was the most kind of, I guess, praised by both sides, it was the idea to, you know, invest in infrastructure and build bridges and all that stuff. And that's what this is. But I agree with John that the politics are so highly charged that, I mean, look what happened this summer. I think we're just looking at more of the same.
Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, John Carney from CNBC. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for having us.
Wall Street, as you may have gathered, got giddy again today. Details when we do the numbers. There's a big gathering in Europe this weekend where politicians will talk about their political and economic future. I don't mean the big Eurozone meeting in Brussels. I'm talking about the annual conference of the Scottish National Party, where the rhetoric just might sound like something out of Braveheart.
Go back to England and tell them there that Scotland's daughters and her sons are yours no more.
Well, maybe not quite so harsh, but recent polls show wide support for Scotland to break away from the UK altogether. And the leader of the Scottish National Party says a breakup is almost inevitable. From the Marketplace European Desk, Stephen Beard reports.
Alex Salmond has always seemed immensely pleased with himself, but now he has good reason. This summer, his Scottish National Party won full control of the government of Scotland.
The Scottish Party, the National Party, carries your hope, and we shall carry it carefully and make the nation proud.
And he might have added, independent. Salmond's dream of a separate state is edging towards reality. Some financial independence is already on the way. The Scots will soon be able to issue their own government bonds, dubbed Braveheart bonds, after the movie about Scotland's historic struggle to free itself from the English.
That they may take our lives! but they'll never take our freedom!
Red-blooded Scots may be thrilled by the talk of freedom and independence, but opinion polls still show a majority against it. Out on the streets of Glasgow, many people fret about whether Scotland could afford to go it alone.
No, I don't think Scotland could cope with that. I don't think Scotland can cope.
You need England.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Do you think Scotland could survive economically on its own?
Probably not.
Many Scots feel more economically secure within the United Kingdom. Magnus Linklater is Scotland editor of the Times newspaper.
I think the experience of our two main banks has really brought that home to people.
He says the Scots only have to think back to 2008 and the rescue of two enormous banks by the UK taxpayers, the Bank of Scotland and the Royal Bank of Scotland.
I think people think, hang on, if Scotland had been independent around that time, who would have bailed out our banks?
The 1 o'clock gun fires out from Edinburgh Castle. Rich in cultural history, this ancient city was nicknamed the Athens of the North. That link with Greece would have had a horrible resonance if an independent Scotland had had to bail out its own banks. Economist Brian Ashcroft says Scotland would have suffered a worse fate than other heavily indebted European countries. He says the Scots should count their blessings.
Scotland would have been in a worse than Iceland situation when within the United Kingdom we're actually doing relatively okay.
In fact, he says Scotland is doing better than the UK as a whole in terms of public spending. It's much more lavish than in England. Free university tuition, free social care for the elderly, all subsidised by English taxpayers to keep the kingdom united.
Those who wish to keep the union together wanted to keep the Scots comparatively happy.
It's the squeaky wheel getting the grease.
Absolutely, and I think that's right. And no UK Prime Minister wants to be seen to preside over a breakup of the union.
The Scottish National Party claims an independent Scotland could still afford its extra public spending. It pulls 1 million barrels of oil from the North Sea every day. Most of that revenue would pour into Scottish coffers and not into the British Treasury.
Though hundreds worship at his word, he's but...
When the Scottish Parliament opened 12 years ago, a folk singer sang A Man's a Man for All That, the national hymn to equality. But critics say the campaign for Scottish independence is the road to ruin. North Sea oil's an uncertain resource. Production has peaked and is declining. The critics say if the Scots really want equality with the English, they're much more likely to get it within the United Kingdom. In Edinburgh, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
A Marquis Duke and all that, but an honest man's up in his might. Get faith, he manna for that, for all that and all.
And now, let's do the numbers. Stocks rallied around two E's, earnings and Europe. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 267 points, or 2.3%, to close at 11,808. The Nasdaq added 38 points, 1.5%, to finish at 2637. The S&P 500 popped up 22 points, 1.9%, to end the day at 1238. For the week, the Dow picked up 1.3% and edged into the green for the year. The S&P 500 bumped up 1.1%, but the Nasdaq gave back 1.1% since Monday. McDonald's beat the street's forecast, and its shares rose 3.7%. The chain's corporate offspring, Chipotle Mexican Grill, saw its shares soar more than 8% after fatter prices for burritos drove double-digit profit growth. General Electric dimmed by 1.9% after uninspiring earnings and concern about slimmer profit margins. Bond prices slipped. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.22%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. A Senate subcommittee on aviation operations, safety, and security is in Seattle for a hearing on the aviation workforce. It meets at the Museum of Flight. Netflix is scheduled to post its third quarter 2011 financial results and business outlook. And on October 24, 1903, Melvin Purvis was born in Timminsville, South Carolina. While at the FBI, Purvis led the investigation against John Dillinger that resulted in the gangster's death. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. From the Marketplace desk of No Surprises, the Environmental Protection Agency plans to regulate natural gas, specifically that controversial form of extraction called fracking. That's a process where resources trapped within rock are essentially flushed out with water under high pressure. Environmentalists cheered today's news. Gas drillers gave a mild grumble. But as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from our sustainability desk, new rules could actually be a win for industry in the long run.
Today's gee whiz technology in natural gas production is fracking, or hydraulic fracturing, which means lots of water shoots into the ground and out during the process, plus chemicals. The end wastewater is what the feds plan to regulate. No details yet, and the new rules are 3 years away. But already, industry's twitchy. Attorney Berkeley Nicholson at Fulbright & Jaworski advises drillers.
I'm not sure that having more regulations through the EPA is the right way to go, but I think that probably it's something that's coming whether the industry wants it to come or not.
There's growing concern fracking endangers drinking water, and a hit documentary on the subject. The fact is, the big drillers already recycle wastewater, or they inject it underground. They do the right thing, says analyst Raoul LeBlanc at PFC Energy.
You have people that are already meeting or exceeding standards, and the regulation really is designed to try to bring up the laggards.
Tens of thousands of big and little companies are fracking, and companies fall short in the self-policing department, according to Steve Levine at Georgetown and Foreign Policy Magazine.
They're incapable, or they do not want to browbeat the bad actors into doing it right. And so all you need is one Gulf of Mexico-type accident in a fracking field.
And the regulators will bring down the hammer. Levine suspects gas drillers, in private, quiet moments, actually welcome the feds. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Those familiar smiley faces at Walmart gave way to some frowns today after the retail giant announced some cutbacks in its employee health care coverage. It's going to stop offering health insurance to any new hires who work less than 24 hours a week. And full-time employees weren't spared either. Their premiums will be going up. Smokers, especially, will be seeing a big jump in costs. Barbara Collins works at a Walmart in Placerville, California. We found her through an employee-run organization called Our Walmart. Collins has been with the store for 6 years. She works full-time as a sales associate.
I pay $10 every 2 weeks right now, and then it's going up to $18. And then my deductible is $1,000 right now. Come January 1st, it will be $5,000. I don't make that much money. I don't see how anybody thinks I can pay those bills.
Walmart says it had to make choices it wishes it didn't have to make, but it will keep paying the majority of costs for employee health care. The company says it currently insures more than 1 million people, including the families of its workers. What the company is not saying is exactly how many of its part-timers work less than 24 hours a week and will thus be left without health coverage unless they choose to pay for it themselves. Just yesterday, the White House released regulations aimed at getting those health care costs under control. It's a move to establish something called accountable care organizations, which would fundamentally change how doctors and hospitals get paid. These 696 pages of fresh regulations just landed on the Marketplace Health Desk, and I know our own Gregory Warner has spent the last 24 hours reading every one of them, right, Gregory?
Every word.
Lots of rules, but they really lay out the future of healthcare as the Obama administration has envisioned it, right?
That's right. And this future, I would say, looks a lot like the Cleveland Clinic or the Mayo Clinic or lots of places around the country where care is highly coordinated. So if you need a specialist or if you need lab work or drugs, it all comes from the same treatment team. And this is more efficient, it saves money, it's safer, there are fewer errors. It's also more popular with patients because you get more face time with doctors and less shuffling between offices filling out forms. But in this country, that model is the exception. these new regulations issued yesterday create basically this huge incentive program to encourage hospitals and doctors and pharmacists and nursing homes and other providers to work together to coordinate care.
So that's where this idea of accountable care organizations comes in. How does this work?
So right now, the way Medicare is set up is that doctors are paid by procedure. Hospitals are paid by the bed, basically. Pharmacists by prescription. You know, everyone down the chain has an economic incentive to do more. Mm-hmm. This model says Medicare will just pay one lump sum to, say, treat a person with prostate cancer. And then out of that sum, the care providers have to divvy up to pay for surgery or chemo or nutrition counseling or whatever they think is needed. That, of course, rewards hospitals for making us healthier instead of just paying for more treatments, which sounds great in theory. The White House issued its first draft of these rules a few months ago. The healthcare industry issued a collective no way, and they said it was too much regulation. This is the White House's second try. It's much more favorable to industry. I called Alex Hunter. He's a consultant who wrote a book about ACOs, and he says what's also interesting is how this changes things for doctors who are historically used to working solo.
5 years ago, if we had gone to the average cardiologist and said, you know, you realize that in 5 years you'd be working for the local hospital, he would have thought you were a communist or at best had given up on the Hippocratic Oath.
Now that cardiologist, you know, might be more willing, the private market's already bringing doctors and hospitals together. And he says these ACO regulations will accelerate that trend.
Okay, so everybody's coming together. Hospitals are happy. But what does this do about the cost of healthcare?
So some people think this is a terrible idea to bring doctors and hospitals together economically, because to combine, they'll have too much power, they'll jack up prices, and we've seen large hospital networks do this. Insurance companies are worried. On the other hand, this model could definitely cut back on the excess tests and the procedures, which don't do anybody any good and are by some estimates a $1 trillion drain on the system. And if patients show that they like these new setups, then we could see a fundamental change to the broken business model of American healthcare.
We'll be watching. Marketplace's Gregory Warner. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
And finally, on the health front, lawmakers in the House plan to investigate what caused a deadly food poisoning outbreak in cantaloupes from a Colorado farm. That outbreak of listeria has killed 25 people and sickened 123 others. Look who's occupying Wall Street. Never mind the cost-cutting and layoffs or the proposed prospect of smaller bonuses. The Wall Street Journal reports the financial industry has hired more Ivy League MBA grads this year than it has since the economy tanked 4 years ago. Today, by the way, marks day 34 of the real Occupy Wall Street. For the most part, the banks have stayed quiet about that open-ended protest, but comedians have not. And so we bring you commentator and humorist Andy Borowitz. He's written an unauthorized response. That means purely fictional on behalf of Goldman Sachs.
Dear investor, up until now, Goldman Sachs has been silent on the subject of the protest movement known as Occupy Wall Street. That does not mean, however, that it has not been very much on our minds. As thousands have gathered in Lower Manhattan, passionately expressing their deep discontent with the status quo, we have taken note of these protests, and we have asked ourselves this question. How can we make money off them? The answer is the newly launched Goldman Sachs Global Rage Fund, whose investment objective is to monetize the Occupy Wall Street protests as they spread around the world. At Goldman, we recognize that the capitalist system as we know it is circling the drain, but there's plenty of money to be made on the way down. The Rage Fund will seek out opportunities to invest in products that are poised to benefit from the spreading protests, from police batons and barricades to stun guns and forehead bandages. Furthermore, as clashes between police and protesters turn ever more violent, we're making significant bets on companies that manufacture replacements for broken windows and overturned cars, as well as the raw materials necessary for the construction and incineration of effigies. It would be tempting, at a time like this, to say, let them eat cake. But at Goldman, we're actively seeking to corner the market in cake futures. We project that through our aggressive market manipulation, the price of a piece of cake will quadruple by the end of 2011. Please contact your Goldman representative for a full prospectus. As the world descends into a Darwinian free-for-all, the Goldman Sachs Global Rage Fund is a great way to tell the protesters, occupy this. We haven't felt so good about something we've sold since our souls.
Now that was pure satire from Andy Borowitz, creator of the Borowitz Report. His latest book is called The 50 Funniest American Writers, an anthology of humor from Mark Twain to The Onion. You can read an excerpt online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, taxicabs are a regular sight along New York City's busy streets, of course, but you can't drive one without a taxi medallion, an aluminum plate that's riveted to the hood of each yellow cab in the city. Two of those plates sold this week for, get this, $1 million each. We called up David Yaske, chairman of the city's Taxi and Limousine Commission, to get his reaction.
I thought it shows that people believe in the New York City economy, and they know that we're going to have a nice, healthy flow of business people and tourists and New Yorkers in and out of yellow cabs for a good long time.
These are corporate medallions, by the way, which can be leased out so investors can make their money without having to actually drive a cab. The plates, or permits, were first introduced for $10 apiece. That was in 1937, though. To put that in context, New York taxi medallions have risen higher than the Dow, gold, oil, or the average American home. The broker who sold the medallions goes by the terrific name of Nat Goldbetter. He's no stranger to these sales. He handled the first sale of a medallion for $100,000 back in 1985. That's a tenfold increase in 25 years. But does that steep rise suggest a medallion bubble? Mr. Yaske doesn't think so.
I'm not going to say the price can only go in one direction because nothing acts that way, but I do think that the fundamentals of the industry are sound and that people are paying based on their expectation that the revenue from the taxi cab will continue to be there year in, year out.
The fundamentals are sound. Where have we heard that before? And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 267 points, or 2.3%. The Nasdaq added 38 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 popped up 22 points, 1.9%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on Marketplace Money, when you got your job, did you negotiate your salary? If not, don't worry too much about it. It's possibly all in your biology.
The low testosterone people would try to convince the person to come up higher. The high testosterone person would say, take the job and shove it and leave the room.
Better check my testosterone levels. I'm Bob Moon. Good having you with us. Hope you can join Kai Rizdahl back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.